This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses the policies and programs that could potentially halt the housing crisis in Salt Lake City. Of particular concern are how to address homelessness, promote affordable rental options, provide rental assistance, and support first-time home buyers. On the state level, the legislature passed SB 39, sponsored by Senator Jake Andereg, to help ease the 45,000 to 55,000 unit deficit in Utah housing. The bill would direct $15 million to a fund for developing low-income housing, $5 million to preserve existing affordable units, and another $15 million of rental assistance for thousands of Utah families. It would also set aside $300,000 towards pre-development costs in rural affordable housing projects. Today's panelists explain how state and city plans to confront the housing gap can work together to address the issue. Included on the panel are Lonnie Eggerston-Goff, Director of Salt Lake City Housing and Neighborhood Development, Dayon Eskich, Senior Research Analyst at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute, and Tammy Hunsaker, Senior Project Manager for the Redevelopment Agency of Salt Lake City. Moderating the discussion is Angela Price, Project and Policy Manager for Salt Lake City Housing and Neighborhood Development. This forum was recorded on February 19th, 2020. Introducing herself first is Lonnie Eggerston-Goff.
Sure. Is this live? Okay. Hi, I'm Lonnie. I have lived in Salt Lake City most of my life. I had 13 years in Alaska, so I came back from there with different perspectives on planning and housing and all kinds of things. I've been in public sector since 2013. Time flies. I have been in housing and neighborhood development for about 2.5 years. And I am very passionate about housing, homelessness, and ways for our community to welcome more people of diversity and different economic socioeconomic status. I have the privilege of having 25 people that work in my division, including Angela, and we do all of the HUD, or Housing and Urban Development, funding, so community development block grants, the funding that helps with emergency shelters for homeless, also for some other smaller programs, HOME and HOPWA, and then we also have 4 staff that work on homelessness, and we are responsible for implementation of the 5-year housing plan, Growing SLC. So we have a lot going on in our group. We are also really lucky to work with all the different departments within Salt Lake, Parks and Public Lands, Redevelopment Agency, Engineering, Planning, Transportation, to make sure we interact with all of our colleagues to leverage the money and efforts towards our community being bettered. Is that enough?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Tammy Hunsaker. I, as was previously introduced, work for the Redevelopment Agency of Salt Lake City, and I have been with the Redevelopment Agency about 4.5 years, but my passion for affordable housing really began as a grad student here at the University of Utah, getting my master's in city metropolitan planning. I graduated in 2012, and I was fortunate enough right after I graduated to get a job at the city, actually in Lonnie's division, the Division of Housing and Neighborhood Development. And I worked on policy there for about 3.5 years, policy and also administering the federal grant money. So allocating funds for the development of housing, for rental vouchers, working on homelessness issues. And then I really wanted to kind of expand my knowledge base, and so I decided to transfer over to the RDA. And the RDA, we focus mostly on capital improvements, so we develop a lot of affordable housing, we contribute money, partnering with public-private partnerships, giving money to private developers, or not giving money, but you know, allocating money for projects that are built by private developers in return for deed-restricted affordable housing. So usually deed-restricted affordable housing is guaranteed affordable for at least 50 years. So since 2010, the RDA has actually allocated $80 million for the development of affordable housing. And, or actually, this is all housing. We usually do mixed-income projects. So this money has resulted in over 3,000 units developed in the city, with about 1,800 of those units developed for persons at 60% of the area median income and below. We do projects ranging anywhere from very low income, formerly homeless residents that are earning about, you know, 10 to 20% of the area median income. We have a project under construction with the Housing Authority doing that right now. We also do mixed income projects all over the city. We do try to focus a lot of our projects in different neighborhoods, so there's equity in where the affordable housing goes. So that's kind of what I've been focusing on right now, is the development and preservation of affordable housing, and I'll pass it on.
Thank you. My name is Dayan Eskich. I work at the Gardner Policy Institute. How many of you have heard of the Gardner Policy Institute? About half. So the Gardner Policy Institute is part of the business school. We kind of serve as almost like an embassy to the state. We work closely with cities, municipalities, private institutions to basically provide data and information to decision makers. So we work very closely with the state legislature, for example. They've tasked us with doing population projections for the state. We work also on a lot of other economic policy issues, such as we just recently published the Utah's roadmap to air quality. I encourage you all, we all care about the air, especially our generation, not saying that the other generations don't care, we just care a little more. And where my work comes in, my colleagues and I, we do a lot of housing and real estate research in general, looking at housing, Utah's housing market in general, and then looking at issues with affordability and with implementation of new units. So right now, for example, we have a huge housing shortage in our state, roughly 45,000 units, meaning there's a bigger demand than there is supply. So we're looking at how to fix those issues. And, you know, people say, well, where are these people? They're doubling up in basements. Our apartment vacancy is at an all-time low. You know, buying housing is very difficult. How many of you have student loans? Not as many as, that's a good sign, okay? About 5 people out of 30 raised their hand. So your chance of owning a home is exponentially greater if you don't have a student loan. So the best thing I did with my student loan, I put it down payment on a condo. So looking at future generations, how we build equity in our wealth, that's another thing we look at. So I'm excited to be here and just to discuss some of the issues.
Great, thank you guys. we're really fortunate here in Utah to have the Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute as just this really great data-driven entity. Salt Lake City works really closely with Kemp C. Gardner. We get monthly or several times a year reports from them on specific housing statistics within the city. Dayan, I'm going to start with you. Can you talk a little bit about some of the factors that you guys are seeing within your research that are contributing to the housing crisis here in Utah, specifically in Salt Lake City?
Well, it's income versus price and rent growth. So if we looked at between maybe 2010 to 2018, the median household income has increased roughly 20%, where the price of housing has gone up across the Wasatch for about 68%, and rent has gone up about 78%. So there's a huge discrepancy. And a lot of that is being driven by the growth. You know, people move into our state from hotter markets. They're able to afford more, which in case, you know, markets just work the way they work, and that helps drive price up. So, and you have a housing shortage, which just, we cannot build units fast enough to alleviate this problem. So you have that discrepancy. You have the global economy moving, employment, you know, we're always ranked first or second in terms of our growth rate nationally. That brings a lot of positive attention to the state, which helps fuel the growth. So it's like this, from an economics perspective, it's a great cycle. But the, you know, unintended consequences of that is we have to struggle with housing affordability.
Do you guys have anything you'd like to add in that realm?
One thing is the economic development of the city. Right now, we've been really blessed in receiving big employers. I feel like it's also it's compensation or income, but it's also figuring out ways for the folks that are coming in to work in those big employers. I'm just going to say the Amazon word out loud. Where do those folks live?
Yeah.
So it's not always just about income. It's availability for the workforce.
And the vacancy rate has been at an all-time low for, I don't even know how many years. Dayan would know that better
probably
than
five.
But it, I mean, at one time it was around 2 to 3%. I think it's bumped up around 4%.
Yeah.
But just the competition for rental housing and the vacancy rate just drives the prices up across all price points.
Yeah, a healthy vacancy in a market is 5%. Right now, just in the downtown area, correct me if I'm wrong, we have roughly 2,000 units under construction, not just permitted. Last year, 2019, we permitted roughly 9,500 new apartments across the state, which is a record.
And it's been interesting to watch all of these apartments under development. I believe between 2000 and 2010, Salt Lake City's population only grew by 4,000 or 5,000 people. And then all of a sudden, all of these apartments were under development, and just more and more population is coming to the city. And so it's been interesting to watch that the vacancy rate really hasn't dropped that much. The quantity of people moving here is keeping that vacancy rate very low.
Great. Just one other piece on that. Dan, can you talk a little bit about the demographics of Salt Lake City, specifically as we are here at the University of Utah, the younger, what they term the millennial generation, and how that specific demographic is impacting housing in Salt Lake?
Well, you have several international offices, you know, from Goldman Sachs, et cetera, located downtown. So Salt Lake City has the highest concentration of single adult high income earners. So eventually, these single high income earners are either going to partner up or they're going to move away. Okay, so there's a lot, you know, Goldman Sachs office, I think, is their third largest in the world, is in Salt Lake. There are several apartment buildings downtown with just Goldman Sachs employees, so which is great, right? You want that in your city as in this global economy. So part of that is student housing, with the university being as a major, you know, major hub of innovation in our state, and with the Silicon Slopes coming in, you know, we often, I think we need to think of I-15 corridor from state Idaho to Arizona. Or Nevada, which one is it? That's getting more and more diverse in its employment and with its demographics, where we're pulling from all over the country. This population is getting concentrated. So the Salt Lake City downtown area is relatively younger compared to the rest of the state, because it's a lot of these young single professionals coming in.
Great, thank you. So we heard a lot last year, the last legislative session, when we were working on SB 34, the affordable housing modification legislation that Senator Andrade ran, about the difference between housing affordability and affordable housing. Can you guys each talk about that and what role the government plays in each of those realms?
I'll start. So affordability is based on income. If you have a lower income, we usually look at 80% and below for Salt Lake City. That definition fits that. Affordability is just the price of the market. Dion's going to be able to give me some better language on that, I think.
Too, there's, you know, affordable housing is a program. But it's a policy program which is offers some sort of subsidy, whether it's low-income housing tax credit, Section 8 vouchers. And when we look at affordability of a housing market, is what percentage of your income goes towards your housing, whether it's a mortgage or a rent. And, you know, it's the 30% is where that kind of came out of thin air. I've never been able to pin my finger down and say, oh, that's where it came from.
But that's what we use.
Yeah,
that's our measure.
So that's what, when we say housing affordability, we mean at 30% of your income.
And the cost burden households, that's what we define as the households that are paying 30% or more of their income on housing. Extremely cost burden is those that are paying 50% or more of their income on housing. So to give you perspective of the data, about half of all renter households in Salt Lake City are considered cost burden, paying 30% or more of their income on housing, and almost a quarter of the households are severely cost burdened. So that's a shocking statistic. I always like to say that everyone needs affordable housing, so everyone should be aiming to pay 30% or less of their income on housing. And from the government's perspective, as Lonnie mentioned, we're really looking at 80% AMI and below. A lot of our programs and the federal programs focus on 60% AMI and below. And to give you perspective, what that looks like is a family earning around $50,000 a year, a family of four earning $50,000 a year, or a single person earning about $25,000 a year, or less. So $50,000 a year or less is 60% AMI for a family of four, and $25,000 a year or less is 60% AMI for a single person.
Great, thank you.
That was Tammy Hunsaker, Senior Project Manager for the Redevelopment Agency of Salt Lake City. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today, a panel of housing experts discusses potential policy tools and programs to combat the gap in affordable housing in Salt Lake City. Here again is moderator Angela Price.
What are the barriers to increasing housing affordability in Salt Lake City, in your opinion?
Zoning. There's a lot of talk right now about ways to increase density, so having more units per acre. In Salt Lake City, we're a lot more open to the idea of density than maybe along the Wasatch Front. And if we don't have mechanisms in place for our planning, our ordinances, our zones, to be able to build residential within proximity to employment, university, then we won't be able to bring developments into those areas. So for instance, right now we have some consideration of what we call share housing or single room occupancy. And that is it used to be called a flop house, or a place where somebody could go and basically sleep and share a kitchen and other common areas. In order for those types of things to be available, the city council and the residents have to support that type of process all over the city. So that's just one example of zoning kind of dictating what can or can't happen. And we, as a city, are working on eliminating those barriers, but it takes a lot of effort. And I think tied to it is the not in my backyard kind of mentality, NIMBY. Probably most of you are familiar with that term. And that influences our policymakers and then also the zoning.
I think zoning is, you can figure every other problem out, but if the zoning is not in place, it doesn't happen. We at the Policy Institute, we surveyed the top 20 Utah's home builders last year, and their biggest concern was NIMBYism, but it's also construction labor availability. We have a labor shortage. Roughly, if you look at number of construction workers per $1 billion of construction value in 2010, at the bottom of the recession, there were about 17,000 construction workers per $1 billion of construction value. If you go to last year, that number was about 12,000. So we've seen that demand just overwhelm the construction workforce. And part of that, too, is we have huge infrastructure projects. We have the airport, and that's exciting. But when the airport wraps up, they're going to pack their tools and go down to the prison site. So I think the construction labor shortage is going to continue going to the next five into the next decade, 5 years for sure. But You have local politics, you have international trade issues right now affecting material costs, you have other varying factors. Financing is good. I think the lower interest rates last year really helped our housing market continue to deliver, because in 2018, developers were looking at not necessarily a pessimistic, but not an optimistic 2019 either. And then that interest rate drop really brought a lot of life back into the supply, which we desperately need.
I would just kind of expand on what's already been said, and to give you kind of some context on how zoning really does affect affordable housing in the city. It can affect levels of affordable housing on all scales and price points. So potentially ADU policy, accessory dwelling unit policy, could help implement affordable housing within already built out single family neighborhoods by allowing homeowners to build or construct an extra unit in their basement or in their backyard and renting it at an affordable rate. ADUs can also help with multi-generational families who need more room, allow aging in place. But zoning also impacts affordability at the higher density apartment building level, because zoning, like even parking ordinances, impact the cost of projects and the ability to implement affordable housing in that project. Some cities have density bonuses that will allow the developer to go higher to then implement some affordable units. So zoning can really touch on affordability on several different scales and price points.
Yeah, and just to expand that a little more, there are several, I'm going to try not to name any cities because I don't want certain people get mad at me, but there are several cities that basically can zone themselves out of a housing market or add additional cost to the price. For example, some architecture requirements that don't really add any value to you as a homeowner, but add, you know, $10,000, $15,000 to the construction cost, which gets passed on to the customer. There's stuff like that. Then there's also minimum requirements. For example, in an apartment project, your average unit size has to be 800 square feet. Where you're near a university and, you know, your market is really studios, you know, then you end up doing studios and three bedrooms. So, you know, what are we doing that's an unnecessary burden? Health, safety, welfare, that's really important. But our cities that have kind of an anti-growth NIMBYism mentality right now, what are they doing to prevent it? You know, are they being a good steward of dealing with this problem, or are they just pushing it elsewhere? And I don't want to answer that question.
And just building off of that, at the city for a long time now, we've been looking at not only zoning through the ability to build affordable housing, but really where that affordable housing is located. Under the Obama administration, there kind of came this idea to the forefront of thought, especially at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban and Neighborhood Development, about racial and ethnic concentrated areas of poverty and where we're locating affordable housing. So in the city at the time, this was a few years ago, I think it might have changed, but there was an identified racial and ethnic area on the west side. And so there's this thought of, should we be providing neighborhood opportunity and providing more access to opportunity in those neighborhoods, and then expanding affordable housing development in other areas of the city where opportunities already exist. So we're really looking at issues of equity with the development of affordable housing as well.
Yeah, if you're really interested in this topic, there's a guy by the name of Ray Chetty. I think he's out of Harvard. But he expands this topic, and basically, you know, it's kind of your zip code is a bigger determinant of your life expectancy than your DNA code. And same concept applies to economic mobility. So if you're in a lower income neighborhood, the odds of you kind of stepping out of that lower income and going up to the next income are really low, versus even if you're a low income household, but in a higher income area, your mobility, as she said, your opportunity for mobility is much higher. So if you look at the distribution of, for example, Section 8 vouchers across Salt Lake County, they're heavily concentrated in Salt Lake City and then on the west side. And if you overlay this opportunity index map over it, it's a lot of red where these Section 8 vouchers are. So you want to start placing affordability in these higher opportunity areas. So you basically elevate people out of poverty, so you can keep getting them out of there.
And it is just a question of neighborhood choice. Like, people should be able to live in the neighborhood they want to live in.
Great. Mayor Mendenhall talks a lot about redlining in Salt Lake, and I think we're going to see a lot from her administration on equity in our community here in Salt Lake and ways to break down those barriers. So thank you for that. You guys all touched on NIMBYism in your remarks. Can you talk a little bit about, study after study nationwide, especially here in Utah, the Wasatch Front Regional Council just did a lot of outreach on their Wasatch Choices 2050 plan, and time and time again, it didn't matter where they were, NIMBYism was the number one component that came out of barriers to affordable housing here along the Wasatch Front. Can you talk a little bit about what we can be doing to break down the stereotypes of those people and not in my backyard in Salt Lake City?
I can start and talk about things that I've observed from the planning side of Salt Lake City and from the perspective of homelessness. Just as an example, the in-between you might have heard of is a hospice program or group that works on bringing folks that are homeless into a space where they can die in a dignified way, so terminal or other really severe problems. They had a very small operation on the west side, and there was a need for that type of facility and the opportunity for people to have that at the end of their lives, and they expanded. They needed to have more space. And there was a huge outcry about folks that lived in the 9th and 9th area not wanting to have those people come. So one of the things I learned actually from Tony Milner, who works in our department as well, is that you have to tell the stories, let people know who the people are that are going to be coming into those types of, and this is an extreme example, but those types of programs, so that it's not just a white blank slate face, it's something that is a real person. And I think that over the course of many months, it turned from being, we're not going to do this, there's no way we're going to do this, to probably only three or four voices that were really in opposition once people began to meet the people that were going to be coming into that type of a scenario. So I think Mayor Mendenhall is a really good example of telling the stories about the folks that are going to be part of that.
I would agree. From my perspective, working on affordable housing developments with the RDA, we really don't get a lot of NIMBYism or pushback. But just working at the city in general, I do think there's more touch points with NIMBYism regarding homelessness. It especially happened back when we were locating sites for homeless resource centers. And there was a potential site identified on Simpson Avenue just off of 7th East. And that became an issue with the community. And I don't think it was ill-intended NIMBYism, but it was just a discussion on the unknowns. People were fearing what they didn't know and what impacts a resource center would bring to their community. So I definitely agree with Lonnie. It's about telling stories, putting faces to the problem, humanizing the problem. But in general, I think Salt Lake City residents are supportive of affordable housing and they are very open-minded. So I don't think it is a problem, but it's not a huge problem in our community. And it does touch on other land use issues like density. Sometimes affordable housing is in denser apartment buildings. So there can be a little bit of NIMBYism around increasing intensity of land uses. So there are touch points there as well.
Yeah. I wasn't playing on my phone. I'm going to read you something, I promise. So thankfully, I don't deal with NIMBYism in my work. So I feel very lucky. But I think it's a bigger issue in the higher growth parts of our the Wasatch Front, such as the southern part of Salt Lake County, northern part of Utah County. And I think it comes down to frustrations around infrastructure as well. When you, I think we can think of more innovative ways to break up our streets. Like I live on South Temple. If 4th South shuts down, I just take another, you know, take another road. So intersection density is as important to affordable housing as actual housing units, I think, because it allows you to navigate through these frustration points such as traffic. But I wanted to share, you know, talking to a lot of home builders, they feel like NIMBYism is becoming very sophisticated, where it's not just a few neighbors coming to city council and opposing you. It's on Facebook, a group grows by, you know, a couple of thousand people overnight. And I don't think it's ill-intended. I think people care. But looking at it from an academic perspective a little bit, there is a lot of misinformation out there as well about certain things. You look at, for example, what happened at the Cottonwood Mall site in Cottonwood Heights. You know, that development group met with the city like 22 times, and they worked through all sorts of issues, and everybody was born, but it got turned down by a referendum. So that adds more uncertainty to an already complex housing market. But this is an extreme of NIMBYism, and it's down in Lehigh, and this was sent to the city from a disgruntled neighbor, and it starts with, I live in a very low density neighborhood. The Mink Ranch is just a block or two north of me. Although the scent from the Mink Ranch is sometimes vomit inducing, I purchased my home in reliance on the fact that my home was located in this low density area. I do not want to live next to these kind of low income people who typically reside in high density housing. I don't want their delinquent children attending our already overcrowded high schools that my children attend. I do not want to deal with the increased traffic that high density housing would bring to my neighborhood. I do not want to deal with the increase in crime and drug use that inevitably accompanies such high density housing units. I don't want my housing value to decrease. So the email just goes on and on. And, you know, this is the type of like misinformation that's out there. So it's one, dude, you live in Utah. Like, it's like your kids just want to get out of the basement and live down the street from you. So I think being, providing more education opportunities, I think just, it's such a polarizing time politically. So I think having more education about what is happening is very important. So.
Great, thank you. Over the past few years, we've seen an uptick in the conversation at the state capitol connecting land use, transportation, housing, and creating that nexus between those three entities. Policy is a really important component of housing here in Salt Lake City. Can you talk a little bit about what's being done at the state and local level and what else you think we could be doing?
So I can speak to some of the transportation and land use intersection. A lot of transit type efforts within Salt Lake City. The policy that has come through from both the mayor's side and the council to provide better transportation connections for folks. We put money from a new sales tax into funding a frequent transit network so that people can live in a place where they want to, whether it's on the east side or the west side, and be able to jump on a bus that comes every 15 minutes. That doesn't maybe sound like that big a deal if you're from somewhere that has more frequent transit available, but it is a really big difference. Makes a difference between, okay, I can get to work on time if I wait for that next bus rather than having to jump in a car that's gonna cost me a big part of my income to pay gas and maintain the car. I feel like the interaction between the density that's possible if you don't have to have a car, transit or other opportunities can potentially make the big difference for the community members. One example that I like to let people know about is Give Group, the Project Open. Projects have allowed, they've built in all electric, so that brings costs for residents down. And they have very carefully set up like a electric vehicle, car sharing, and other ways for people to take advantage of being able to walk to places or take transit. So I think that the policy side of it has to come from, you know, residents and constituents wanting to make sure that that is happening, and then the political will on the state side sometimes doesn't line up with the local side, if that makes sense. I think that also around homelessness, we've seen a lot of effort to have it be the state that pays everything, and local governments not wanting to participate in that. And I think that SB 34 that you mentioned had a requirement for cities to participate in more progressive types of policies in order to participate in the funding. So those are, for me, the two key things.
Yeah, that legislation was passed last year at the state level. So it ties the receipt of transportation funding to implementing a moderate income housing plan on the city level. So the state does require all cities above a certain size to have a housing plan. And last year there was finally legislation that forced cities to actually do the plan and implement the plan. Before that, there wasn't really teeth. So that's helping a lot with the transportation housing connectivity by tying the transportation funds to housing. Just looking at transportation in general, it is interesting that Salt Lake City's population doubles during the workday by in commuters. So housing and transportation policy, I think, impacts growth along the Wasatch Front by several different realms. It's impacting not only traffic on our streets, but air quality by having people drive out of the city to afford to qualify for a mortgage is impacting growth along the Wasatch Front.
Yeah. An interesting stat on that. If you live out in like an Eagle Mountain, Saratoga Springs area, your household transportation costs are somewhere between $22,000 to $25,000 versus if you live, let's say roughly like in the I-215 belt loop, it's about 15 to 18. So huge discrepancy. So that concept of drive till you qualify is there, but I think people often forget to factor in that transportation cost. But kind of your question, I won't touch too much on the state policy, but the problem is big enough where you're having a lot of public-private partnerships, and it's starting to fuel some innovation with prefabrication construction methodologies. I think we need to rethink our financial mechanism tools, how someone qualifies for a mortgage. We need to start tracking creditworthiness of or credit ratings of renters, which is something I think that can help when you go apply for a mortgage and you don't have any real credit history. You're going to get turned down even if you make $150,000 a year. So there's a lot of innovation happening there that I think in this next decade will really come to light.
Great, thank you. Kind of along those same lines, we've been seeing states like California, for example, taking some pretty drastic measures to address the housing affordability crisis in California. Can you guys talk about some of the things that we're seeing at a national level policy-wise that could or should not be replicated here in Utah?
I'll start with the California and the Oregon, and I don't know if they could or should not. Leaning towards should not, but the fact that they're being rolled out at a state level gives them a chance of success because they're not capping their rents, they're putting a growth limit on it. I think, I can't remember which state it is, but it's 5% plus inflation, which gives the opportunity still to account for cost increases. When you have just flat out rent control, it basically stifles growth and it pushes growth to the next municipality and it makes this one area more expensive to build in, traditionally speaking from an economics perspective. So I think it's, the goal is not to get there. I think this is why in a pretty red state, you have some very conservative state lawmakers looking at what would be considered fairly progressive and liberal policies, because we don't want to get to a California or Oregon in terms of our housing costs.
One thing California recently passed, I think it was either a year or two ago, is legislation that on a state level provides that there's a recording fee on all real estate transactions that is then deposited in, I think, at the county level, kind of a housing development trust fund type model. So statewide, there's an ongoing revenue source for the development of affordable housing. Currently, Utah doesn't have that. Every year, the legislature puts money in what's called the Olene Walker Housing Loan Fund that provides gap financing for the development of affordable housing, but there's not this ongoing revenue source like California just implemented.
I feel like also on a national level, the need or the requirement of cities to come up with new ways of doing things, like Detroit, for instance, and other cities where, you know, people have literally lost their homes and the homes have been overrun by bushes and weeds and basically of no value. Cities need to step up and have been stepping up to purchase the land and then be able to caretake that, whether it's in a community land trust or other mechanism to bring new housing opportunities. So I feel like that, I hear that almost every day. There's some realm of how do we as a nation look at the way that we transform blighted or really impacted communities.
There's one thing I was popped into my head, just remembered. This state is currently working on a affordable housing preservation loan fund, and I think that's also a really important factor to not lose the affordable stock we have right now, because when it goes on the market, usually an investor will snatch it up, you know, polish it up a little bit, put some new countertops in, and jack up the rent, and there goes that supply. So it keeps creating the problem further, I think.
Another policy tool that is most often implemented at the city level is inclusionary zoning, which forces all new housing developments to have a certain percentage of affordable units in that development. And this has been evaluated across the board. It's implemented in several cities. Some say it's a success. Some people don't like it as a policy. It's not really used in Utah by any municipality. Park City has a version of it, but you can also implement that tool and not force the affordable units to go in the development that's being built. You can have the developer pay an in-lieu fee that goes into a trust fund for the development of other affordable housing. So that's another widespread policy tool that's used across the nation.
That was Tammy Hunsaker, Senior Project Manager for the Redevelopment Agency of Salt Lake City. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is Moderator and Project and Policy Manager of Salt Lake City Housing and Neighborhood Development, Angela Price.
Thank you, guys. Dan, you touched a little bit in your remarks on public-private partnerships, and we're seeing that we can't address the housing crisis on our own. It can't just be local government. It can't just be the state. It can't just be the development community. We really need to come together, and that's what we're known for in Utah, right, is our collaboration and the ability to get people around a table despite our political, religious, or who we represent. And I think that that's a really great thing that we have here in Utah. Can you talk a little bit about what innovative partnerships are happening or some partnerships that you think should happen?
So there's the traditional, and these guys have a lot more experience with it, doing tax credit units, you know, or the city brings the land, the developer brings the construction, stuff like that. There's a lot of, you know, that's a proven model that's worked and that continues to work. I wish there was more of it, to be honest. Some other things I think we'll see in the state in the coming years is looking at our public ownership as an asset. So how can we leverage, what's a surplus asset? Instead of getting rid of it, how can we use it in partnership with a private entity to come up with new revenues? So instead of just selling off the land and taking our $1 million or a dollar, depending on what it sells for, how can you create new revenue streams from it? And it doesn't just apply to cities. It can apply to school districts. It can apply to colleges, public universities. So I think that's where the realm of it is going. There's a great case study out of Denmark where they did this. They repurposed a whole Navy shipyard, I think it was, and they put new development in it, and everything all the revenue that the city earned from that, used it to pay the financing of their new rail station. And everything within that rail station that appreciated in value, they get a percentage of. So it's an ongoing, and we have some examples of that in Utah. We have up in Ogden and the Arts Center, how they fund some of their activities is through this system. So I think there's a lot of innovative ways to think about our public assets and how we can leverage them for good. In terms of other, I think, construction methodologies, I think, is a big opportunity. There's some local developers here, for example. I think Ivory Innovations, Ivory Homes, they have the Ivory Prize, where they seek these companies that are doing innovative things in housing affordability. But we also need to look at outside the U.S. For example, we have a few Japanese businesses that own home builders here, and talking to some of those guys, they look at the modular prefabrication process in Japan, and they're like, they're 50 years ahead of us, you know, just how quickly and efficiently they build. So where can we trim costs? I think is that at the end of the day, your biggest cost in housing is the actual cost of building it. So that's where the bottleneck is. The cities, we need to figure out, and you know, that's a very difficult process, but can we really take the burden off of some of these other factors that we've been traditionally doing for 50 years? Because we haven't really done that much construction advancement in some of these areas. So.
Can I also add, it's been really looked at, but not really anybody that's come to us and been able to show an actual product they could do in 3D printing. That is something that I think can make a really big difference for small single family.
Well, I think they're a builder out of California. They do all of their prefab in Poland and get it shipped from Poland. And it costs them $1 million to ship it. They'll do either 500 or 1500 prefab homes, and they ship them to California because it's cheaper to build it in Poland and ship it than it is to build it and transport it in California. So I think we can do better there.
And I think from the city and the RDA's perspective, this has been a tool that has been used for several years, but cities and RDA's and universities have a lot of excess land that they're not using. So ways to use land for the development of affordable housing to get the cost down is key. We have seen at the city a lot of developers who haven't previously done affordable housing come to the table and want to implement affordable units without financial benefit to them. They just want to be part of the conversation and part of the solution to the problem. Everyone's recognizing we're not going to fully build our way out of this. So there's also discussion at the state level and through different partners on voucher programs that can potentially take place. So we can look at solutions through building, through preserving existing affordable housing, and through also providing money for monthly rental assistance. So those are all solutions that or potential partnerships that could be formed. At the city, we've also been in discussions with unique partners that are coming to the table, like large healthcare companies. Have funds that are set aside for community-oriented purposes. So we've been talking with different companies about partnering on affordable housing. The same is true with actually the university and with big industrial banks who have funds that are set aside for community purposes. So we're really trying to think outside of the box at the city and tackle the problem not only through the zoning but through these new partnerships and through potentially unique building types like the printed house.
Great. Well, I want to leave some time for questions. Do you guys have a quick 30-second closing remark, or should we open up for questions?
Go.
Go? Okay. Anybody have any questions for the panel? We'll start with you and then to the back.
What does the process look like currently for a typical homeless person trying to get into housing?
It's complicated. If someone has just come into a homelessness situation, say last night they slept on a cousin's couch, there is a centralized place where folks can go. It's called the Wiegen Center downtown. They are assessed for what can we do right now. And if it is a temporary situation, it might be more effective to have that person live like in a, give a hotel, a motel voucher just for a temporary setback. Maybe it's job is expected in a couple of weeks, that kind of thing. Or if it's been a long-term kind of homelessness situation, getting them into the Homeless Resource Center, which allows stability for, I mean, there's a place to sleep, three meals a day, laundry, and other things that, you know, being on the street or in the former downtown shelter wasn't available for folks. Once folks are stabilized, we have case managers that work for our nonprofit partners to help people learn where housing opportunities might be. They call them housing locators, helping folks figure out what, in the very low vacancy rate market, what places are available for folks to move into. You probably know that there's a stigma or a misperception, I would say, that homeless folks are crazy, addicted, you know, the criminals, all those kinds of words get used by some folks that observe people maybe that are unsheltered that choose to camp out, for instance. But I think getting folks connected to the right job training or other services, it takes time. And there are a few entry points, but we're working on better ways to engage with people that are experiencing homelessness. Does that help?
There was a brief mention of the idea of affordable housing for everybody, even those that don't qualify for low income. So my question, there's a couple of ideas out there that the building of affordable housing and the building of those luxury condos that are also being built downtown, that both of those, even though they can be a good thing in their own right, they also cause more stress on the housing market. And is that true, or is there anything that's being done to ameliorate that problem? Thanks.
I don't know if there's anything done to ameliorate that problem. I don't, you know, the reason we're seeing such a high, you know, high amount of luxury housing happening right now is because there's a huge demand for it. You know, there's two projects I know right now that are going to be high rises that are going to be, you know, $35,000 to $5,000 a month, that are, you know, like I said, downtown is a concentration of single higher net worth individuals. So the demand is there. You know, if you're going to build, you're going to try and squeeze every dollar you can, because you're putting, you know, $10-15 million of your own money out there, and you want to make sure you get the best bang for your buck. So that's what's driving it. How you alleviate it, I think there's, these guys mentioned some of those programs, you know, whether you have inclusionary zoning, whether you have some sort of additional funds to continue to provide the affordable. The biggest, I think, if you ranked affordability issues, I think those at 30% below area median income are the most vulnerable, because they're, you know, incident, a car breaking down, a trip to the emergency room away from homelessness. So how do you shore up that part of the dam first and then move on upwards? I think that's where I would start.
I would just add to that, saying that there are a lot of policy issues kind of connected to your question. Yes, affordable housing is a huge one, and the one I think we all focus on the most, but there's also this idea that you have to connect housing and the housing that's being built to the workforce that you have. So I think because Salt Lake City is attracting, you know, Goldman and other high paying firms, there is this need for higher price points in housing as well. So,
and I would say also, if you don't have the luxury products, then folks are buying or renting down. So that pushes all the way down to those in the 0 to 30% AMI.
We had, sorry, let's go the woman right there and then this gentleman over here.
If I recall, the Cottonwood Mall controversy ended with a state Supreme Court decision about the, you know, the nature of what I guess was a zoning decision, or at least a decision to approve that project. Have there been any subsequent cases, or what do you see as the impact of that court decision on, you know, on legislative bodies' decisions in this area?
I don't think there's been anything since that.
I think what I hear from other builders is they're in their financial performance, they're putting in litigation costs. They're expecting some sort of opposition. And right now, you know, there's been a few here and there, but that one's the most prominent one. There's been issues, not necessarily by referendum, but out in Tooele, there's been a big breach of contract and some lawsuits. But what I'm hearing is the goal is to never get there, and builders will walk away from a project. They'll just say, you know, it's just not worth the time and money to put into it. I'll go somewhere else. So it's having a, I would say, overall negative impact, because it's putting in another barrier of uncertainty into an already complicated housing market. Yeah, yeah, it definitely assured them a little more, so.
In your opinion, oh, my name is Eric, by the way. In your opinion, how can we increase affordable housing without promoting gentrification? I feel like that's a really big thing. Now, I'm from Chicago, so I'm speaking on like my experience specifically. But that's just something that's kind of been on my mind a little bit. And like, if it is an initiative, like, what does that assistance look like for those from underserved communities?
I can answer that. So I work for the Redevelopment Agency, and we work in project areas, which have been defined as areas of the city that have suffered from disinvestment. So by nature of the areas that we work, there are a lot of lower income residents in those neighborhoods. So it's really looking at preserving the unique character of the neighborhood. We do commercial development as well. So working with existing businesses to improve their space instead of just displacing businesses and having, you know, new yoga studios move in and stuff like that. But with affordable housing as well, there's this narrative at the city that some neighborhoods don't need new affordable housing because there's already too much affordable housing there. But I think there's a distinction that needs to be made between affordable housing that's naturally occurring just because of market conditions and affordable housing that's insured to be affordable for the long term by a deed restriction. So as the RDA works in these neighborhoods, we do try to implement deed-restricted affordable housing as we go, because we want to make sure that the communities remain available to all residents, existing residents, and all price points, and not just, you know, implement housing that's, you know, a higher price point. So it's really looking at tools to make sure that there is a diversity of income in all neighborhoods. It does go back to neighborhood choice and what I was speaking about a while ago with the neighborhoods of opportunity. It's an initiative of the city to get affordable housing in neighborhoods that currently lack affordable housing. So it's preserving neighborhood choice, not only in the neighborhoods that are so-called gentrifying, but also implementing affordable housing in neighborhoods where currently some residents don't have an opportunity to live because they don't make enough money. For example, up here by the university, if there's someone working at the university who's quote-unquote low income, they should still be able to live up here and have a home by where they work. So it's kind of a multifaceted approach to make sure that we're implementing deed restriction as we go in neighborhoods that are changing, but also trying to get affordable housing in areas of the city that currently don't have it.
Well, let's give a round of applause to our panel here today.
If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.